Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. This episode 205. I am your host Rob Cope, and today we're talking to Delphio Marsalis. But first, a listen to his track "New Suit" from his incredible new album "Uptown on Mardi Gras Day." Delphio Marsalis, welcome to the Jazz Podcast. How are you doing?
Excellent. How about yourself?
Yeah, all good, man. All good. We just had a listen to your tune, "New Suit," from your new album, "Uptown on Mardi Gras Day." What an amazing album. It's so uplifting. It's so energetic. Tell us things.
Well, you know, it's New Orleans, and that's what the sounds of New Orleans are equated with. You know, I think it has a long, we have a long tradition going back to the freedom of the African drums. And there's a certain amount of celebration that comes from the motherland. And we try to tap into that whenever we play.
You've really captured the essence beautifully, because it's got the sort of clean sound of a studio album, but the energy and the love of the music all in one. How do you record something like this and get it to sound so good?
Many hours of work, many hours. But, you know, been in the studio for many years, and I started when I was in middle school thinking about sound and how can we get the perfect sound. And we haven't gotten there yet, but I'm hoping one day. And, you know, that's all I could say, you know, working with Branford and Winton early on, and that Winton especially had, it was dissatisfied with the sound of his early recordings. And he tossed me in sixth or seventh grade to find out how to make the sound better. So I went on this journey that I'm still on. And it first had to do with the size of the recording studios. So the first thing is to have a large enough room where you get an ambient sound. The smaller rooms, a lot of times you hear a recording and it's clean, but everyone is in booths, so the sound doesn't have a chance to resonate. So that's the first thing. It helps to have the horns in the same room. I don't know if you know the expression of vibration and sympathetic vibration. Do you know this? Yeah, so the sympathetic vibration just means if you play a note on the piano and hold it and play another note, you know, maybe a third or a fifth, then you can hear the harmonic series. So what happens is when you have horns in the same room and they're playing together, the same thing occurs. Whereas if everyone just tracks individually, you don't get that. So there's the potential for more richness when everyone is in the room, the horns. And then when you have four, five, six, you have, you know, 10, 12 horns playing, man, that's where you get the fat sound. At any rate, man, it's just, we just kind of know what to do with the studio. It's hard to really say that there's one particular thing other than you want a large room. You also want to have separation of the bass, electric bass. We have electric on a number of these songs, and New Suit is one of them. And that makes things really, really easy, actually, because the challenge of acoustic recording is always the drum set and the acoustic bass. So, and as far as the energy, man, you know, that's what we're known for. My band is known for, you know, we play more like an R&B band would play. A lot of right. Jazz artists, they play like jazz. Like jazz kind of gotten a bad name because it's we're going more in the direction of the symphony. So if you go to a symphony, for example, you know, to go to check out the London Symphony, man, it's great. They sound really beautiful. It's great, but it's just different. You can't go to that expecting to have a certain kind of a feeling. You just go and enjoy the sound of it. And to me, jazz is kind of going in that direction where people respect it and they sit there and they don't have that same kind of influx of emotion. So we try to play more like an R&B band. You know, that's what I would attest to. That's what I would say.
It's so punchy. It's so like juicy.
That's R&B, man. You know, it's just like, you know, you listen at the way Michael Jackson recorded. And early on, I would compare my recordings to Michael Jackson recordings. Especially because I thought his were really clean. They were well recorded and the engineer spent a lot of time. Some of the Beatles stuff was good. Beatles were early on. It was some of it's good, but their technology wasn't the best only because of the time period. Parliament and the Funkadelic, Earth, Wind and Fire, really excellent production value. So in addition to knowing the jazz thing, I listened at that because, you know, just the sound of the music, the way it's structured is differently. Ellington and Basie, these orchestras, usually they just played in the same room at one time. They did a little bit of overdubbing, but nothing substantial. I think Ellington overdubbed on Anatomy of a Murder, if I'm not mistaken. At any rate, so, you know, man, it's just like you just get there the best way you can. And I have the sound in my ear and I just try to get to that sound. And, you know, Andrew Bayham really did great arrangements and he and I worked together really well. And that helps. And then the musicians bring the energy. You can't, you know, you can't. That's just what that is.
Do you book them yourself? Do you know everyone or do you have someone who like knows who you like?
No, I mean, I know everybody that was playing on this. It's hard to do that. It's hard to get this kind of a sound. And we were a band. You know, we worked together before the pandemic a lot as a band. And that comes through. That comes through in the way that we interpret the music. So, you know, can't say enough about that.
I am a saxophone player. And when I listen to something like this, and the saxes have that sound like it's one, but it's five. It's just brilliant. It's incredible. I just can't turn it up loud enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the trumpets. Everybody stepped up. You know, it was interesting to me because we hadn't played together in a while.
Right.
And I called this session. And so we did do on some of it, we did the rhythm section first. A record like this, for the most part, we did the rhythm section first. And then we put the horns all together. But when we played whatever the first song was, and I said, oh, yeah, okay, this is going to be one of those kinds of days. Like, I just knew everybody was there. Everybody was ready. It's like, okay, this pandemic is over. And this is our chance to represent. And man, it was on. So I just had a feeling, you know, it's like sometimes you just knew. I said, oh, okay. So that was refreshing. And, you know, we hear the brass bands in the street a lot of times and we hear these guys playing. And man, they play with such energy all of the time. I mean, from the first note to the last, the whole night long, man, it's really unbelievable and incredible. So we like to have that energy, but also they play mostly at one volume, one or two maybe. And we want to be able to play at five, six different volumes. So, you know, this, I'm trying to think if there's a song that really represents, nothing really represents how soft we can play, but we play really, really soft on the gigs. And then we can play at a medium volume. And then of course we can let her rip. So there you go.
Wow. This band then, how much time do you spend? Like, do you write all of this out? Like scores, Sibelius? Is it like a couple of years?
No, it was not that long, but there was some time put together. Some of the songs are based on the original arrangements and we just made them for big band. Other ones, you know, in the big band, the great thing about it is that it gives you such a wide palette of sounds and you have so many different options. It's just a question of what to do, you know, and the main thing for us, it's always coming from a rhythmic standpoint of view. So the New Orleans sound, for example, just the rhythms are they're unique. They're a certain kind of way that it has to lay, finding the balance of what does the music actually require, you know, because we could put all kind of hybrid chords and this and that, but it's like, you know, it's not necessarily going to serve the music well.
I love that about the album, about the whole approach to making music at your level is serving the music rather than sort of showing off everything you can do in one track. Be like, look at all these years of knowledge I've got.
Yeah, well, and I'm trying to bring the music back to being for the people, and the musicians have been left to their own devices. And I'll tell this brief story about Dennis Wick, who is the trombonist in the London Symphony. He's not anymore. When Dennis Wick was like in his late 20s, he was first trombone, and he had to play Mahler's Third Symphony. He's famous for having a great trombone solo. And he did one recording with Sir George Schulte. And then a couple of years later, he did another recording, and the conductor was, I believe the name was Hohenstein. And when you read the reviews, everyone talks about the Hohenstein version. And I think it's, you know, Mahler was Jewish, Hohenstein was Jewish. It's like, oh, yeah, this is such a great recording. But, man, that Sir George Schulte recording is, to me, I'm like, Lord, emotionally, it's just really, really serious. But, you know, Dennis Wick, he's not playing perfect. He's like, because what they say is Sir George Schulte was making him play so loud that he's missing notes. Like, the notes are not coming out really clean because you can't at that volume. So I called Dennis Wick, and I asked him about this. And I said, what about these two recordings? And he says, well, he says, as I recall it, I didn't feel Sir George Schulte had the proper respect for the musicians. I mean, he's a great conductor. He said, but when we did the recording with Hohenstein, he allowed us to pick the takes and go in and this and that. And he said, in fact, I'm pretty sure that I asked Schulte to use the take that he didn't use. But the lesson there is that all musicians left to their own design will choose what is technically correct over what is emotionally correct.
Mm.
So no offense to him or no offense, you know, but, you know, so you listen at the Hohenstein version, they're not missing any notes. Everything is like this and that. But emotionally, man, Schulte understood like the emotion of the music. And it's like, man, that recording is just so killing Mahler's Third. But at any rate, I'm saying that to say that with this band, that's what we really go for, the emotion of it.
Yeah.
More than the technical proficiency. I mean, it's still, you know, it's not like sloppy or this.
It's not sloppy.
Yeah. You know, but there's a way that you have to play it. And there's things that we learn, for example. And so my thing is to learn these different styles. So there's a thing that you learn about playing Basie, Count Basie's music, the way the Basie band played it, the way they articulated, the way that they would crescendo on lines that are moving upward, the way they cut the notes off. And we still don't have all of that, what they did, but you can use those techniques when you're playing this music. The Ellington band, they did something a little different. They had a different approach, and Ellington's music had more kind of counterpoint going than Basie. Basie band, a lot of time, they was all playing. It was a dance band. My favorite band of those is the Jay McShann's Orchestra, man. And they were just like a ragtag type of band. But the feel was so good. And this is what I think we need now, is more bands that are, quote, jazz bands or jazz orchestras that have a great feel.
Yeah.
That's what the people need. And this is what the brass bands of New Orleans have.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought the same thing when you mentioned Earth, Wind & Fire, because some of their recordings, they're not super clinical. Some of the horn parts, there's some split notes, but it's the character of the music, and it's the, like, it's the gesture that comes across. You know, it doesn't take anything away from it at all.
Right. Right. There's one melody where the trumpet player just cracks. What I'm talking about on our CD, what is it? Seemed like it's Midnight at the Zulu Ball. And I could have easily cut it in where he didn't miss it, but I said, oh well, that's just what it is.
You've done it now.
Yeah. You know, if the feeling is there, a lot of times you gotta go with it, you know.
Do you ever have the solos overdubbed on the album, or are they done like in the moment with the band?
I think all of them are overdubbed.
Right.
One way or another. So we sent the track to Branford, and he just did his thing on his solos, and we put him in. But his, talk about feeling time.
Because he's playing soprano.
No. He's playing tenor.
Right. I'm going to edit that out and sound really intelligent.
No. He plays soprano on the last song.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but he plays tenor on Big Chief, and then he plays tenor on Uptown Boogie.
Right.
And then he's playing soprano on Mardi Gras. Yeah, but his time is so impeccable, man. It's like, how do you even do that? So, but the key is, you know, if you're overdubbing, man, there's a way that you have to do that. There's a way that the rhythm section has to play so that it sounds like it's all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's just years of being in the studio and knowing what that is and making sure that it sounds a certain kind of way.
I know. As not being a rhythm section player, I've never had to deal with it, but they sort of have to like imagine stuff that's not there and throw ideas out that are going to be bounced off of later, you know?
Right. And that's the idea though too, is you can sing a solo in your head. Or a lot of times what I'll do is I'll just tell it, if it's two choruses, then I'll tell the drummer, okay, when we get to that top of that second chorus, then you start to increase the heat. And then by three quarters of the way, that's when you on fire. And then it just comes down at the end of that chorus, so that the soloist at least has an idea. Man, I did an overdub solo on a guy's record, and the drummer sounded like it was the drum machine, or it sounded like, you know, one of those play along records.
Yeah.
And it's just difficult to generate, you know. So, I mean, some guys can do, especially saxophone players, I think they can do that. They shared all these different things and they can just run.
Yeah, the Brecker licks out and just start pasting over the top.
Yeah. Which I guess, you know, yeah, you can do that. And the guy says, well, what happened to, I sent him the first version, and he says, man, why don't you do like some of that stuff you were playing with Elvin? And well, Elvin's gone. I mean,
yeah,
you can't just dial that stuff up. But anyway, it's just, we're always preparing for the next thing.
So. Oh, that's so funny. If someone said that to me, I'd have been like, why don't you do it first?
Yeah. I mean, I knew what he meant. Yeah. But Ron Carter once told me that. He said the guy who called him for a session, and he said, man, I want you to, you know, to play like what you did with Miles in the 60s. And Ron says, okay, what are you going to be doing?
that's amazing. Oh, my God, what a great reply. Yeah. What exactly will you be doing whilst I'm turning it on? So what's coming up in the diary? What have you got planned? Have you got a tour? Have you played some gigs? Sorry if you've already done. The album's just come out. I'll just throw that out there for the listeners.
Yes, the album came out at the end of January. And, you know, Mardi Gras is going to be on us on Tuesday. We got a couple of gigs out of town Monday and Tuesday. Actually, next week I'm going to Longwood Gardens, which is in Pennsylvania, and I'm doing a concert. It was postponed due to the pandemic. It's called From Beat to Bird, and it's the music of Ludwig von Beethoven and Charlie Parker.
Oh, wow. And
2020 would have been the 250th birthday of Beethoven's, it's either birth or passing, but I think it was his birth, and it was the 100th anniversary of Charlie Parker's birth. So the idea was to present, it's such great music, both of their music on one concert, from a compositional standpoint of view. and just, you know, hearing this great music side by side and back to back. So we're doing that next week, and we have a string quartet and a jazz sextet.
Will you do it like a half of each? How does this work as a
concept?
Okay.
Yeah. It probably won't be that, though. It'll probably be, so it might be 10 or 15 minutes of beat and then 10 or 15 minutes of bird and then alternating. And if I can finish this arrangement, then we'll have the string quartet play one of Charlie Parker songs with a little kind of, you know, I haven't really decided yet, but we're going to rehearse it next week. And I know I'm doing something at least a little different in terms of how you would hear Charlie Parker's music and what we'll do with it.
That's really cool. What a great idea. I have not heard of anything like that before, where two things that are quite different but have this link are just like, let's do it. Let's put it together, you know.
They're different but the same. You know, and I grew up studying classical music, and my teacher was always about finding the similarities, finding the greatness in works. So, you know, if we're learning Palestrina, or if we learn in the Gregorian chants, or if we learn in, you know, Wagner or Verdi or Mozart or Penderecki. I mean, you go down the list, you know, he was just say, you got to find the greatness in these works. And said, great music has no expiration date. A lot of times you hear folks say, oh, that stuff is old. It's like, if you know how to tell a great story, you know,
yeah.
When was Romeo and Juliet written? In almost every kind of tragic love story since is based on that. Kind of way. So at any rate, yeah, that's what we want to try to do. We'll try to, you know, give a new fresh outlook on some of this music.
That sounds brilliant. When I do quite a lot of music theory teaching at the moment, and there's bits in our like syllabus of like, you know, figured bass, and it's like you're like going back like 400 years here and looking at chords and inversions, and so much of it's just like chord two, chord five, chord one. Like you say, you look at it and you're like, really nothing has changed. You just kind of, we present it differently. We got some more interesting rhythms maybe, but essentially the rules and the harmony is exactly the same.
Yeah, well, rhythm is where it's always changed. So if you listen to it, I mean, Bach had some intricate harmonies. Bach, man, you listen to that stuff that he was dealing with. And I'm saying he was the most consistent composer, I think, in history. Like, he never wrote a bad thing at all from what we could tell of what he has. It's like, but it's rhythmically, it's different than what Mozart took that another step rhythmically. And then Beethoven comes in. He did change the texture. Like, Beethoven was more like the kind of the grumpy old man. So he had that really thick texture. But the main changes have always been, to me, rhythmic. And then you go to Wagner, it's a different level of rhythmic complexity. And then Stravinsky, of course, I mean, he freed everybody up once Stravinsky came out. So I think it's very similar in music, and a lot of the students are studying the harmonies. And it's like, man, the harmony is relative. You know, if you listen to Don Byas and Slam Stewart, 1939, I mean, that's extremely sophisticated harmonic understanding. But still, from a swing perspective, they were swing musicians. And then you listen at, I mean, even Charlie Parker for a while wasn't playing with that level of sophistication. I don't know if you know that recording of I Got Rhythm, 1939, Don Byas. Man, that's like, but the saying,
I'm going to go listen to that.
Oh, man, it's like sick. But it's always, it's more of a rhythmic, but that's the thing that's harder to deal with. It's harder to get to a rhythmic understanding than it is, you know, harmony. You can study it and you don't necessarily have to hear it a certain way. You can just say, okay, I can play D flat over G and it'll give me an outside sound. And then I can resolve that. And yeah, we can play some for you now, huh? What do we do? Share it. Hold on. What do we got? Slam Stewart.
Oh yeah.
You don't have to listen to too much of it. That's what's going to come up all of the time. I Got Rhythm. Hopefully it's not an ad. Can you hear it?
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. Ooh.
Just listen to that, what he starts to solo.
1939. 39.
But check the harmonies out. I gotta go get a charger. I'll be right back.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. Every time you kind of like, oh, I think I get what that. Oh no, this is happening. The first time they get to the bridge, it's like, oh my God.
So, you know, and that's so, and I used to be into more of like the, what do you call it? Like the absolutism of Charlie Parker was the absolute greatest in this and that. And, you know, but you realize that many, many great things are, you know, Shakespeare, or Charlie Parker, they are the result of many people coming together. In the case of Shakespeare, you know, you had Thomas Marlowe and Thomas Kidd and this guy Green, and they were all writing great things. And Shaq just kind of, in the Globe Theater, gave them an outlet. The theater, the way the theater kind of exploded at the time, it gave them an outlet. And here with Charlie Parker, you know, you had the recording devices, but also you listen at Benny Carter and Buster Smith and these guys. I mean, they were playing. It's not like, you know, Charlie Parker just came along. It's, you know, we see it in different things. Like in the NBA, they want to pretend that, you know, Michael Jordan came along and all of a sudden he was the only one that could play basketball. It's like, man, these guys were out here serious. You know, he may have risen to the top, but it was because there was everybody else out there.
You got to be pushed. You got to, there's never just one person on their own, I don't think.
Yeah. So, but I'd say, so, you know, and the great thing about what we do at our Jazz Orchestra too, though, is that everyone has an opportunity to play. Roderick Paulin is a tenor player and he's playing most of the solos on the recording because he plays the most authentic New Orleans style saxophone at this point in history. That's what it is. And I like what Branford was able to bring because he brings more of the modern element. So I like to have what you'd consider traditional and the modern kind of mixed in there. And that's what he does. But, you know, the other sax players, I mean, and most of them are not from New Orleans.
Right.
So they've been here for a while and they sound great together. But the key to me, if we're playing New Orleans music, is you have to have that New Orleans sound, you know, and I mean, trained as great as he was, you know, he's from North Carolina. So he got a just different take on it. Bird's from Kansas City, you know. So the question is how to really get that authentic New Orleans sound.
It's wonderful to me that the only way to truly have it is you just have to have grown up there and be like a surrounded by it your whole life. No one can just come along and take that history and that culture, you know?
Yeah, well, you can also study it and be a little better at it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, but you're right. I mean, when you grow up in the middle of it, I mean, Roderick Pauling, he grew up playing in the streets. His dad was a brass band player, so he can play in the brass bands. You know, he could play in a jazz orchestra. He can play on Bourbon Street. He could do top 40 gigs. I mean, you know, he's just a really, really great musician. And it's just a different, the New Orleans thing just has a different sound to it. And I think it's important, and it's important for me. It was not as important to me early on in my career to represent New Orleans. But after Hurricane Katrina and seeing the influx of musicians who have descended on the city from other places, now they have gigs in the clubs and they're playing their version of whatever they play. But it's important also to have that New Orleans sound, you know, it's very important.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful city. There is so much opportunity there. Last, like coming from London, you're like, oh my God, there's so many venues. There's so much live music. It's really quite amazing that you can't imagine it. I don't think till you see it in person, the scale of the scene that is there, the amount of energy and how lively it is.
Right. You know, another place, you've been to Austin, Texas, but the music scene is just way different. But they have venues. There's a whole street. I forget what they call it, but is it Music Row or something? I'm like, man, it's kind of similar to, it's like the, almost the country version of New Orleans. You know, they got like a lot of rock bands and different things, Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the flavor of New Orleans, which is really, really great. And we just got to capture that. So I think the CD really does a good job.
It does a beautiful job. Let's celebrate. Let's finish the show by listening to Carnival Time. What could be better? I absolutely love this tune. I must admit, I hadn't heard this before. And this lovely lady, Anne, who your publicist, we work together loads. She's the very best in the business. I think the world of her. She's so good. She sent me this and she was like, it wasn't like, you must listen to this or else, or play this now, otherwise you might die. It was just like, here's an album. Have a listen to this if you like and see what you think. And I pressed play on it and I was like, what is happening? I blew my mind. I can't wait for the listeners to hear this. Do you have any parting thoughts about this track before I hit play?
No, I mean, you know, I think the original is really good. Have you heard the original, Al Carnival Time?
No.
So he does it at a faster tempo. It's a risky thing to say, man, check that out too. But his thing is, you know, he plays it at a faster tempo. And we maybe need to just give him a little pub. You know, you might listen and say, wow. But, you know, it's really energetic. I think for sure I'm going to get some kind of a commercial at this point. Let me play you a little bit of, wait, is this the one? No, I want the original. I think this is the original here. Yeah, this is the original. You got to have So this tune is really different, right? Because it's like a 9-bar phrase.
Yes, there's that like overhang on Carnival Time. I love that.
Yeah, and then it's got another thing. It's like is it a 17-bar phrase? So it's like it's this strange. I don't know how these guys came up with this. Mardi Gras Mambo is the same thing. It's got like an extra bar. And it's like, but it doesn't feel like it's an extra bar. It seems like that's the only way that it could be.
Yeah.
So we heard that, and the question was, what can we do? Now we got a big band. So Andrew Bayham, he threw that more like a big band shout chorus, is how we started off with something that's more like what a big band would play than the smaller ensemble. So this is a fun tune, and I guess that's what I would say. That's it.
Oh boy, here we go. Delphio, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been a massive pleasure to talk to you.
Appreciate you having me, man. Yeah, let's do it.
Oh, yeah, y'all.